Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you for being here. I am as pleased as you that John Meacham is here to speak tonight. However, before I hand the microphone over to him, let me talk with you briefly about our Share a Book reading campaign. The Share a Book campaign really focuses on three points. First, encouraging all parents to read to their children every day. And two, supporting adults who struggle with reading or who struggle with English to reach out for help and to use our community's resources and to learn to read. And then finally, encouraging every single resident of Nashville to have a library card and to use our library's great resources. Obviously, each one of you already loves reading and you value literacy in your lives. However, I'm asking you to become more active ambassadors of literacy. You can read to kids in the community. You can volunteer to tutor adults learning to read. You can donate books to youth who don't have books of their own at home. You can volunteer with the library or other community organizations that focus on reading. We would love to have your help in whatever way is right for you. We are so fortunate to have our Nashville Public Library, a great organization, not just buildings and books, but of people, ideas, and community. Our library continues to grow and to grow Nashville as a city of readers. Tonight, we need to thank the library, along with the Library Foundation, Parnassus Books, and Humanities Tennessee for their good work in bringing John Meacham and so many other modern leaders of the written word and culture to our city. Not only are we thankful for and respectful of the great authors who share their words with us here, but we hope and believe that those authors are also thankful for and respectful of the warm, intelligent reception they can count on receiving in Nashville. I know we're talking about books tonight, but let me mention something that's on my mind, which is the show Nashville. I don't know how many of you have seen it, but you got to love the show because you got to love the name, and you got to love the way our city looks in that show. But I was thinking about the show the other day. You know, of course, they have a mayor's race in the show, you know. And in the very first show, there's this great scene where Powers Booth, who plays the father-in-law, who's kind of a bad guy, who's looking to make some deals, who's trying to persuade his son-in-law to run for mayor. And so he's talking to his son-in-law, Teddy, and he's reluctant to run for mayor, and he says, you've got to do it. Nashville's not some backward city. This is an economic and cultural juggernaut. So I obviously love that. And let me be the first to say that you can't believe everything you hear on TV, but that is the gospel. And one of the reasons we're a cultural juggernaut is that this is really nice for me to be able to say this, and I haven't been able to say this introducing another author, is that John Meacham has moved to Nashville. Mr. Meacham wrote the bestsellers Franklin and Winston and American Gospel. Mr. Meacham also authored the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of President Andrew Jackson, American Lion. We are fortunate, of course, to have the Hermitage, the home of Andrew and Rachel Jackson, right here in Nashville. The Hermitage is perhaps the most authentically preserved home of an early president and provides the historical and archaeological resources to explore Jackson and his time. Tonight, John Meacham will be speaking regarding his most recent study on President Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Reviewers describe John's present work as nuanced and persuasive, find that he has humanized Jefferson as never before, and conclude that John brings fresh information such that there is not a significant detail out there in any pertinent archive that he has missed. John Meacham's achievements also extend beyond his writing to politics and publishing. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as the executive editor of Random House and a contributing editor with Time magazine. Mr. Meacham previously co-anchored PBS's Need to Know, and he was the editor of Newsweek. Among his many accolades, he joined the Society of American Historians and received the First Amendment Medal from the Anti-Defamation League. John has recently, as I said, made Nashville his home, and we are honored to invite him to join our community and happy to have him as a neighbor, and we are thrilled to have him tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, John Meacham.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. With that kind of introduction, I know you're expecting Connie Britton, and I apologize. I apologize for that. And just a couple of things quickly. It's all downhill from here when someone says that many nice things about you. But there is a built-in source of humility when you are a writer, and it's when you're on the road, which I've been for a month or so now. But 4 years ago, when I was out talking about our fellow Tennessean, Andrew Jackson, I was at a book event in Washington, on the Washington Mall. Lovely event. Laura Bush had started it. Mrs. Obama was continuing it. Beautiful setting, of course, the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial. And a woman ran up to me and said, "Oh, my God, it's you." I said, "Well, yes." Existentially speaking, that's hard to argue with. And she said, "Will you wait right here? I'm going to go get your book and have you sign it." And I said, "Well, it's a retail business. Yes, ma'am. I'll be right here." So I stood there loyally. And hand to God, she came back with John Grisham's latest. And so what do? I mean, you can't embarrass her. So I signed the damn thing. Not wanting her to know that Grisham is taller and richer than I will ever be. So whenever I get a little puffed up, I always remember that lady with that book. And I hope she enjoyed that autograph, and I hope Grisham never saw it on eBay. I'm delighted, Mr. Mayor. Thank you to Karen and Ann at Parnassus, which has been such a wonderful, wonderful resource, obviously, for the community. And as you all know, the investment that Nashville made, and that led by Karen and Ann to enter that world, was an enormous counter-cyclical vote of confidence in the Republic of Letters. And God bless them, and let's all make sure we spend as much money as possible there. And because without that kind of cultural outlet, we can't have a Jeffersonian culture. We really can't. And so I salute them with great gratitude. And to the library and the Library Foundation, one of the first things my daughter did when she was started school here was to come to the library and make a model of it. And she gave it to me, a model of the library as part of a class project. And just a moment ago, I was saying, "Well, you know, I have this on my desk." And my fact-checking daughter said, "It's on your printer." So she helped with the book, so there could be no mistakes, possibly, arguably. So I'm grateful for your hospitality. I do want to talk about Mr. Jefferson. He's a person about whom many people have opinions, I've found, in the last 4 or 5 years. The first question I tend to get is, "Well, you know, a lot has been written about Jefferson." And I'll say, like Rick in Casablanca, "Really? I was misinformed. I thought this was kind of a pioneering thing." But he resonates, and our presence here tonight talking about him, I think, affirms his role as the most versatile and most vivid of the founders. I admire and salute Washington, Adams, even Hamilton, although I should stipulate quickly, at least my guy didn't get shot in Jersey. Key point. The other thing, my beloved wife is here, who I must say, by bringing her to Tennessee, I have fully rescued her from her upbringing in Mississippi. I've just spent 4 days in Mississippi, so I won't have to go back for 4 years, so I can say that sort of thing safely. But I do want to say, in a post-Petraeus era, for the record, at no point in the writing of this biography did I have any inappropriate contact with Thomas Jefferson. Hamilton might have sent shirtless emails, but not my guy. So I want that to be clear. He speaks to us because he spoke so fundamentally and elementally to us then. A 19th century biographer, James Parton, who also wrote a wonderful biography of Andrew Jackson, wrote, without irony, that if America is right, then Jefferson is right. If America is wrong, then Jefferson is wrong. Now, that is one hell of a burden to put on any one person. Nobody says it about Adams. Nobody says it about Washington. Nobody says it about Hamilton. Nobody says it about Madison, Rush, Franklin, no one. But Jefferson, yes. And why is that? Why does he continue to speak to us again and again, generation to generation? Well, I think it's because he represents the best of us and the worst of us. And I think we intuitively know that if we don't consciously know it. And so I want to talk about how he represents the best and how he represents the worst and why I think that eternal tension is so important and ultimately so illuminating for our own time. I write biography not only because I like talking to dead people. It's when they talk back that you're in trouble. Any biographer, by the way, who denies that they've ever not had a Jack Nicholson in The Shining moment with the axe running through the house is lying. We all have that moment. I think that being in conversation with the past is absolutely essential because it is, in fact, the only way we have to check our assumptions, to test, put things to the test of experience, to subject things to the quintessential Jeffersonian test, which is what libraries are about and universities are about, and what Jefferson wanted politics in many ways to be about, which was to fix reason firmly in her seat and submit everything to that tribunal. Fix reason firmly in her seat and submit everything to that tribunal. A wonderful goal, not always realized, perhaps the exception more than the rule, but an important way of thinking about democracy and about republicanism. And Jefferson thought about this and put it into action in ways that no one else in that era can lay claim to have created such a deep and lasting legacy. So, best of us, worst of us, and then I want to talk a little bit about what I think his legacy and his life can actually tell us about what we can do now. And we can't rip these guys out of context and say, all right, if Thomas Jefferson were here, what would he say to Boehner about the fiscal cliff? That doesn't quite work. But there is a spirit. There is a spirit about different political eras that can inform our own, and I think that Jefferson certainly does. So I want to start with, if you will, put your minds into 1790. It's a fun Thursday night if you're out thinking about 1790, you gotta admit. It's 1790 in New York. It is the new capital of a new republic. George Washington was sworn in as president on the 30th of April, 1789. Thomas Jefferson is on his way back from France after his years as minister there. He lands in Norfolk. There are rumors in the newspaper that he is to be appointed the first Secretary of State. He doesn't receive the official letter, so he starts moving up through Virginia toward Monticello, stopping at his kinsmen's houses along the way. He could have done that for the next 100 years because Virginia makes Tennessee look like a sprawling, unrelated metropolis. Virginians were the early masters of intermarrying, and stops at, we can get to Mississippi jokes on that later if you want. There was a point at which, I was in Mississippi earlier this week. At one point at a conversation in Greenville, I was related by blood or marriage or both to about 30% of the people there. So, is my wife, oh, she is, hey, sweetie. Gonna be a long weekend. He's on his way, he stops at Eppington, Jefferson does, his in-laws, and he gets the letter from Washington. And he goes through a classic, what every politician goes through, Mr. Mayor, sorry, which is whenever a politician is thinking about going to run for office, what is the formulation? Think back for a second. What do you hear? You often hear, well, you know, some people have asked me to think about running. It's always the passive voice. It's never, I'm thinking about running, what do you think? It's that, well, some people have come to me and consulted me. It's Cincinnatus chic. Everybody wants to be Cincinnatus, even if they don't have a plow. And so Jefferson does this with the appointment. He goes through a sort of a dance of seven veils with James Madison, who's cutting the deal between Washington and Jefferson. You know, how brilliant does Washington really think I am? Does he really think I'm the right person? I'm sure he does, but, you know. So this goes on for a while, but we always have to do it. We all do this. So he accepts, goes to New York, can't find rooms. His first place he wants to live is what he called the Broadway. Can't find a place there. So he takes rooms on Maiden Lane in New York and immediately goes to war with Alexander Hamilton. They are, as Jefferson puts it, daily pitted in the cabinet as two cocks, constantly at each other's throats, constantly at war over the nature of government, over the nature of the republic, the nature of the financial system, whether strict construction or broad construction, all these issues are playing themselves out in vivid, tactile ways in the first cabinet. Washington gets a little tired of this, and so he writes a letter to both men. And here's what he said. Washington wrote to Jefferson and Hamilton, "How unfortunate it is that whilst we are encompassed on all sides with avowed enemies and insidious friends, that internal dissensions should be harrowing and tearing our vitals." Harrowing and tearing our vitals. There are two remarkable things about that phrase. One is it's George Washington's, and it's memorable. He was many things, a phrase maker, not one of them. The other is the tactile and emotional nature of it. That generation, when they were really upset, when they were really intent upon making a point, spoke in terms of the body. They spoke in organic terms. And so for Washington to go immediately to that image of the body being pulled apart, because they thought, remember, quite explicitly, for them the body politic meant something. It meant that a republic in its proper form was going to be a properly functioning body in all its different parts. And Washington believed this was going too much. This was too harsh. So here's how well it worked. Jefferson wrote back of the illegitimate son of Nevis, his Treasury Secretary colleague, Alexander Hamilton, "I will not suffer the slanders of a man whose history, from the moment at which history can stoop to notice him, is a tissue of machinations against the liberty of the very country which has received him and given him bread and heaped its honors upon his head." So that Dr. Phil moment did not exactly work out the way it should have. Hamilton wrote back saying that Jefferson was a fanatic in politics and an atheist in religion, and an anonymous letter writer in that era wrote Jefferson saying, "I think you ought to get a damn kicking, you redheaded son of a bitch." So, I know that a lot of you all want to think Karl Rove invented all this. I know Karl wants you to think he invented all this, but he didn't. Partisanship and division have been part of the oxygen of democracy from the very beginning. Jefferson himself briefly shared a view that we might be able to coin a phrase from recent years, reach a post-partisan era. He gave that up about halfway through his own presidency, saying that men have divided themselves into parties by differences of opinion over whether the interests of the many or the interests of the nobles should predominate, since those questions convulsed Greece and Rome. So Jefferson was looking all the way back to the ancient world and the way we look back at the founding, trying to find out to what extent was the spirit of faction, was partisanship, was the very things that we all spent the afternoon perhaps listening to the radio or checking online or watching cable or worrying about as we all head toward our cliff and we come out of this re-election campaign. You know, how corrosive is partisanship? Can it be overcome? It's never really going to be overcome. The key is to manage it and marshal it. Because when you think about it, and as Jefferson went through his years, he came to believe, why shouldn't we disagree deeply? Why shouldn't we be at each other's throats in a passionate way? We can be civil. We should be more forbearing about it. But deep division is intrinsic to the American experience because the very point of the country is not to settle arguments, but to contain them peaceably. The Constitution of the United States, if you think it was written for quick action, take another look. I have heard, senior federal officials, both past and present, of the most senior kind say that muse that the Constitution might not be up to the governance challenges of the 21st century, that an 18th century system designed to check faction and check impulses and check great reform might ultimately be at some point outdated. Now, we haven't come with anything better, but it's an affirmation of the fact that we live in a world, we live in a system where solutions are not ready at hand. And it was supposed to be that way. So when I started to do this book, I was looking at Thomas Jefferson and his political life, partly because, as many of psychiatrists would tell us, what people don't mention is often most important. And the tombstone at Monticello, which is the great history Jeopardy dork question, what are the three things on Thomas Jefferson's tombstone? Author of the Declaration of Independence, founder of the University of Virginia, author of the Virginia Statute for Religious Liberty. No mention of the presidency, the vice presidency, the Secretary of State, Ambassador to France, House of Burgesses, Confederation Congress, all the way back. From 1769 to 1809, however, Thomas Jefferson was more or less constantly in public office or thinking about it. On the very few occasions when he retired, he was doing so often to plan his next move. He left the Washington administration after the first term, and I don't know if this has any resonance in your minds, but to have a Secretary of State who left in the first year of a second term who might have some thoughts about running for president herself down the road tends to, I don't find that an implausible drama. By the way, I just have to say this quickly. President Clinton, I think he's still out campaigning. And so if you see him, you might tell him that the voting's over. I worry that Bill Clinton's going to end up like the Admiral in Mary Poppins and have just his own ship up there, you know, giving speeches constantly. Hey, man, how are you? But whenever Jefferson left, he was thinking about the next thing. And he did it because he was irresistibly drawn to politics. Part of it was the way he was born. If you had to have fate deal you a hand in the middle of the 18th century, you wanted Thomas Jefferson's hand. You wanted to be the eldest son of a landowning, slave-owning, growing, well-connected Virginia family. That's what you wanted. And he got every card. He got a tall, big, adventurous father, an explorer, a surveyor, literate man, kept Shakespeare, kept the Spectator in his house, maps and books of exploration. Jefferson grew up with this image of a heroic father whom he wanted to emulate, and a very tough, aristocratic, resilient mother who, after her husband died and her plantation burned, she just kept going and kept going and kept going. He inherited his father's sense of adventure and his mother's steeliness, and it was a hell of a combination. It was a perfect political combination as he went into the Revolutionary era in the 1760s and 1770s. So the political Jefferson is my focus here, because I think that's what he did every day for 40 years. He held office, he tried to create solutions, provisional solutions, because in politics that's what solutions are, to get to 51%, to solve a problem and get through it as best he could. And that's what our greatest politicians have ever done. The remarkable thing about Jefferson, and the reason I think he's the greatest politician of the early republic, is not only did he hold office for that 40-year period, but from 1800 to 1840, for 36 of those years, either Thomas Jefferson himself or a self-described Jeffersonian was president of the United States. Only John Quincy Adams is the exception. No one else has ever done that. Lincoln didn't do it. Jackson didn't do it. FDR didn't do it. Reagan hasn't done it. Interestingly, the one person who might is Bill Clinton. It's not inconceivable. When President Obama sort of outsourced his reelection there in the late summer, he became a Clintonian president in a way that, looking back, we may link him in a longer version. But that would be the first one since Jefferson. So what was it? What was the nature of the skill that brought Jefferson to that pinnacle? My view is that he had the rare gift, one shared only, in my estimation, by Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton, but we're getting a little too close, so let's stop about 1980, of being able to project a vision of the ideal in a way that convinces all of us, or enough of us, I should say, enough of us to take action, to make sacrifices of opinion, not because it's simply present pain, but because we begin to see it as an investment that will improve our own lives, or an investment that will improve the lives of the nation going forward. Here's a game for your car ride home. Try to think of a successful American political leader, presidential or in social reforms, who did not speak in the vernacular of optimism. Negativism is a good starter and a terrible finisher. If you come out saying the world is ending, then you're going to get a good couple of days, but you're not going to last very long. And so if you think of one, email the mayor. But I can't. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. We're the last best hope. This is all a language with the shining city on a hill. Ronald Reagan is the only man, by the way, who could improve on Jesus. The phrase that Jesus used in the Sermon on the Mount was city on a hill. Reagan added shining. And now everyone thinks Jesus said shining city on a hill. It's marvelous. You know, only he could do it. I made that point to Mrs. Reagan once. She was thrilled, as you might imagine. Clinton, don't stop thinking about tomorrow. That wasn't a random song that came up. You know, these were all people who projected a vision of the future in which mutual concessions of opinion were the fuel to a stronger and better place. That's a different skill set than the other thing that the other element of political greatness, which is pure legislative mechanics. Being able to gather our trust and affection, translating it into votes, to the holding of office, the management of public opinion, and the passage of a given solution. That's the fundamental political transaction in a democracy. That's a different thing than being able to paint a picture of a brighter world. Philosophers can do that. Preachers can do that. It's harder for people who are really good at cutting deals and finding the soft spots in someone's character and someone's hopes, ambitions, appetites, dreams, to make them vote with you to make that happen. Two different skill sets, visionary, mechanic. Jefferson combined them both, far more so than George Washington, far more so than John Adams, far more so, dare I say it, than Alexander Hamilton, far more so than James Madison. That was his gift. He could articulate an ideal, and he could maneuver to make it real. And I would argue that as we look at people in the future with whom we are asked to trust ultimate authority, that might be a pretty good test. Do they check both boxes? A lot of folks check one, and a lot of folks check the other. But do they check both? And that's the key. And I think that's one of the reasons Jefferson represents the best of us. He represents the best of us because he was really good at defining the tasks and the skills required to run the American presidency in a world in which this was a very tenuous and contentious and contingent nation. We forget this. This was the damnedest close-run thing you ever saw in your life, which is what Wellington said of Waterloo. I believe that you can't understand early American history without seeing the period between 1763 and 1815 as a 50-year war with Great Britain. And it's as though you're trying to describe the forces that faced Harry Truman to George H.W. Bush without reference to the Soviet Union. The wonderful thing about that argument is that the British did come back. So Jefferson wins it. Jefferson was totally paranoid about the possibility of a returning monarchy, of a returning British force, of a returning British system. He believed that the survival and success of the American experiment was constantly at risk. And guess what? In 1812, he was proven right. As President Nixon taught us, even paranoids have enemies. And Jefferson was right. And so I think understanding his daily reality is absolutely critical, because I believe that we learn more from these people in the past when we fail to look up at, when we resist looking up at them uncritically or down on them condescendingly, but instead look them in the eye. And what I tried to do was actually look Jefferson in the eye. And in that sense, I believe, when we recover the fact that this is a human being riven with shortcomings, sins, failings, flaws, occasionally duplicitous, always hypocritical, because guess what? He was human. I don't know about you all. I'm hypocritical about four times a day, and that's a good day. These were men before they were monuments. And because they overcame seemingly insuperable obstacles in the past, that means we can too. And I believe that as firmly as I believe anything about the study of history and the crafting of biography. And that the people who represent the best of us, like Jefferson, have that illuminating role to play. The other critical thing about Jefferson on the best of us, before we get to the other side of the ledger, is imagine what it was like to be alive in the 1760s and 1770s with this remarkable transformation that was going on in human consciousness. For the first time in century after century after century after century, princely and priestly authority was breaking down. And suddenly the individual was being given charge, at least in an intellectual sense, of the fate of his own soul, of the fate of his economic destiny, of the pursuit of happiness, if you will. The Protestant Reformation, Gutenberg and the spread of democratic materials, the translation of scripture into the vernacular, the scientific revolution, all of these things led to reforms in the old world, but led to an entirely new thing in the new world, a new order of things, which was the motto that Jefferson and his subcommittee, one of the great subcommittees in all time, Jefferson, Adams, and Franklin, assign them anything, whatever you got. If you have a fundraising problem, give it to them. That was the motto they came up with after the Declaration of Independence. This was a new order of things. And it was a new order of things because society was becoming, not fully, the promise was not realized. The promise hasn't been realized now, tonight, in December of 2012. But the promise was made and put into progress, put into motion, to change society from a vertical to a horizontal vision. Kings and priests were no longer to be predominant, but individuals who could be trusted with their own decisions could then presumably be trusted with the government of themselves. That was where the life of the mind and the life of politics met in Thomas Jefferson's life and in the life of the founders. Now I think we tend to see the life of the mind and the life of politics as regions, when you travel between these two regions, you require a passport. For them, these were contiguous states with porous borders, and it absolutely mattered. The world of ideas absolutely mattered, because what Jefferson was doing was trying to create a political context for these ideas about human nature and the changing nature of authority to find political expression. And that was a truly revolutionary thing. It's the one place, I think, where Thomas Paine was exactly right, in one of the most overstated but wonderfully eloquent remarks ever, when he wrote in Common Sense, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again." Well, we don't. We don't have it in our power to begin the world over again. Edmund Burke was right in countering that. But in that sense, in the sense that the old world was able to move around the edges, but we were able to start more or less anew, was a central American contribution and a central American characteristic, and absolutely essential to creating the kind of country that was able to withstand the storm and strife of all these centuries. And I think that that fixing reason, finding the ability, finding the willingness in our own lives, in our own time, to make sure that reason plays a large role as opposed to superstition and revelation and received authority, is honoring that sacrifice and that insight from long ago. And it was that. It was a sacrifice, and it was dangerous. There's a wonderful story about the signing of the Declaration of Independence. There was a man from Virginia, a signer named Benjamin Harrison, who weighed 300 pounds. And there was little Elbridge Gerry from Massachusetts, who was about 5'2" and weighed, you know, not much. And they're signing the Declaration in Carpenter's Hall, and Harrison turns to him and says, "You know, when the British come and hang us, it'll be over with me in a few minutes. You'll dangle for days." You know, they said, if we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately. Thomas Jefferson was fully ready to be arrested and taken to the Tower in London. He was terribly disappointed, actually, later in life to find out that he had not been convicted in a bill of attainder in Parliament. The rumor was going around, so he was very proud of that. Unfortunately, it didn't happen for him. But this was a tenuous thing. And I want to be very clear. I don't think the American founding should be treated as a kind of historical Zoloft. You know, this is not something we look back on and think, you know, we shouldn't be so depressed. You know, they were great men. You know, they were great, but they were human. And they were a lot like us. They were a lot more like us than we tend to think. And so when we talk about Jefferson representing the best of us, I think he represents the promise of liberty, the promise of the Enlightenment, finding political expression, and the idea that politics can be a means of both intellectual, economic, and cultural improvement. Nobody believed in the politics of progress more than Thomas Jefferson. "I like the dreams of the future far more than the history of the past," he said, which sort of messes with my way of life, which isn't good. But he believed that, as he put it, the march of civilization had come over the continent like a cloud of light over the seacoast and moves across the continent, and where it stops, no one will know. And it hasn't stopped in many ways. And I think that that's something that we intuitively or consciously know about him. And that's why we continue to talk about him and think about him. Now, the worst of us. Jefferson was an unrepentant and difficult slave owner. He was, as a young man, somewhat of a reformer on the question of African and then African-American slavery. He tried on 4 or 5 occasions as a young man to reform the institution. He lost publicly and decisively each time. There are 2 things politicians hate most, and that's losing publicly and decisively. If I'm right that he was quintessentially a political creature, then that had a critical effect. In 1784, in his most significant defeat, he had drafted a Northwest Ordinance that would have prohibited slavery in the Northwest Territories. It lost by a single vote in the Confederation Congress. And in a marvelous moment of eloquence, Jefferson wrote, "In that hour, the voice of heaven itself was silent in an awful moment, when for the lack of a single vote, the fate of millions still unborn hung in the balance." It's a marvelous line. No president ever spoke in needlepoint pillow quotations better than Thomas Jefferson. But if you're me, you can't have it both ways. You can't argue that here was the most formidable politician of the early republic. Here was the greatest man who amassed power and kept a fairly coherent political ideology going for 40 years. And let him off the hook for stopping these reform efforts in 1784. 10 years later, he was Secretary of State. 2 years after that, he was the Vice President of the United States. He then ran against John Adams. No one since John McCain, until John McCain, had so much trouble with their vice president. Come on, she never disappoints. Then he becomes president for 8 years, and then he becomes a senior statesman with Madison and Monroe asking his advice a good bit. He never tried to reform it again. So why was that? Part of it was he didn't see a politically viable way forward. For him, emancipation also meant colonization or a repatriation, which was not an uncommon view at that time. What One of the many ironies of Thomas Jefferson's life is that he could not envision a biracial society in the way we know society to be now, even though he was creating one at Monticello. And I think, like a lot of politicians, it's true. I think, like a lot of politicians, he believed that as long as he was there to keep a lid on, to control it, everything would be fine. But otherwise, he feared, and this shows how aware he was that it was morally wrong. He was totally fearful that the moment there was a moment of emancipation and African Americans and whites began living side by side, that African Americans would turn on their white masters and kill them. You do not fear that if you are not aware that you are complicit in protecting a morally indefensible institution. It just doesn't track otherwise. Intellectual consistency requires that you say you realize that Jefferson saw that. And the quotations in the Jefferson Memorial are all from this era where he pretzelized himself into knots. That's a technical historical term. I don't want to get too fancy on you. I was in Los Angeles last week, and Bill Maher was interviewing me, and he was late, so I told the crowd he was busy at choir practice. But at one point, I started a sentence with, well, historiographically speaking, and he said, please don't ever do that again. But so don't overwhelm me. It was a good lesson. He knew that, as he put it, there's nothing more certainly written in the book of faith than that these people are to be free. I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just. All of this was about divine judgment for slavery in a way that Lincoln picked up. Lincoln picked up that argument about, particularly in the second inaugural, about how the war came because the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether, was Lincoln's phrase from the Psalms. They were closer on this than one might think. So why was it? Why did he give up? If he'd fallen off a horse in 1785, William Lloyd Garrison and others would have pointed to him and quoted him as an early advocate of abolition. But he didn't fall off that horse. I think it's because he was fundamentally a political creature. His base was in Virginia. His own life was totally made possible by slavery. One of his first memory, was of being a child on a pillow, being handed up to a slave on horseback to be taken on a family journey. One of the last things that we know that ever happened to him was that he was in his alcove bed in Monticello, was uncomfortable, tries to signal to his white family what it was that he wanted done. No one understood except an enslaved butler who reached over and fixed the pillow, and all was well. So from the beginning of his life to the end of his life, it was made totally possible by slavery. So there's no excusing this. There's some explaining it, but there's no excusing it. Here's what I think we should do with that. And I submit this to you. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. used to say that self-righteousness in retrospect is easy, also cheap. And that our wagging our finger at the past may make us feel good and better about ourselves for a time. But ultimately, it's not a particularly useful thing to do. My own sense of the moral utility of history is that we should appreciate the failings of the past, not to create a false sense of superiority, but to raise our own moral antenna about the problems of the present that require our own moral and urgent reform. I submit this to you. How many of you can think of a series of issues where, at this hour, a significant number of Americans of goodwill are making a case based on political, cultural, and economic considerations to change public policy that a significant number of Americans in the mainstream do not wish to do for reasons of political, economic, and cultural convenience? I can think of about six to start. Here's another game for the car. If one generation's reality, debated about but still accepted, is another generation's unquestioned evil to the point where we find it repugnant to think about what was a matter of course even 20 years ago, then I just would be awfully careful about historical self-righteousness. And I don't think I need to bang away at this point in the American South. My native region, I grew up in Chattanooga. I don't think anyone here needs to be walked through the examples that immediately come to mind about our own failings in the lifetime of many of the people in this room. So that's what I would submit that we should do with this worst part of the Jeffersonian legacy. I think because he had such a good box office, we should end with Abraham Lincoln. If you are a man and you are involved in politics, I think the best thing that can ever happen to you is that Daniel Day-Lewis is chosen to play you. I submit that from my Pulitzer Prize-winning wisdom. Here's what Lincoln said about the phrase, all men are created equal, in 1859. He was declining an invitation to deliver a birthday address, a Jefferson birthday address, and wrote the following. All honor to Jefferson, to the man who, amid the concrete pressures of a struggle for the national independence of a single people, had the coolness, forecast, and capacity. It's a wonderful phrase. The coolness, forecast, and capacity to insert into a merely revolutionary document an abstract truth applicable to all men and at all times, that today and in all coming days it should be a stumbling block to the very signs of reappearing tyranny and oppression. Not a bad legacy. Thank you all very much. Thank you. We have time for some questions, which always worries me because y'all know stuff. We want to do a couple and we can... Yes, sir. That's a great question. I'm repeating because we have folks outside the room. Did my focus on the political Jefferson, was that the beginning thesis or did it emerge from later on? It was there in the very beginning, exactly 4 years ago, when I was out talking about Jackson. And I did realize, by the way, that I should have saved Jackson for my retirement, because whenever he was mad, he just shot someone. And that's much easier to dramatize than Jefferson would write a letter, be very eloquent, blah, blah, blah. There are moments with our fellow Tennessean, with Mr. Jackson, that it's kind of a combination of advising consent and bonanza. So that's an important point. The Hermitage always welcomes my analysis of this. I try to point out that Hoss would make a good icon, but anyway, it was there from the very beginning because one of the impetus, and to some extent, was I was so fascinated by President-elect Obama, because here you had a tall, cool, cerebral politician writer who affected an ambivalence about politics while he was awfully good at it. And I started thinking, have we had anyone like that? And Jefferson pops up. Also because Jefferson and Jackson are bookends of the early democracy movement. Democracy having much more, is a phrase much more applicable to Jackson than to Jefferson, which is really more republicanism. But I was also struck by, you could not have come from a lower rung of acceptable white society than Andrew Jackson. And you could not have come from a higher rung than Jefferson. And yet they ended up in the same place politically. And I had the Jackson saga in my head, and I just, you know, everything about Jefferson actually would have argued for more of a Federalist kind of worldview. He was rich. He would have been fine. You know, he would have been fine investing in the financial class, but he had an ideological commitment to a different course than what would have made the most economic sense, could have made the most economic sense for him in many ways. And so I was interested in what were the set of ideas that were so strong that that's what positioned him politically. And I think the ability to, what did surprise me was his ability to see the threat of a British reassertion of authority was a critical element, and I think an underappreciated one, in his life, in his political life. So when I sort of puzzled that out, I ended up believing I was on the right track. And I mean what I say about the tombstone. That's always interested me. Because he sent us, because who's going to be against enlightenment, education, liberty of conscience, and equality? You know, that's a nice place to be. And a lot of people really do think of him as, he had a beautiful house, he liked paint, you know, food, wine. But what he did every day, really, most of his life, was try to govern in the arena, making trade-offs. And one of my many character flaws is I like politicians. I've liked them since I was a kid. In Chattanooga, there was a police commissioner named Bookie. It was not because he spent a lot of time here in this building. And Bookie was had some problems with the grand jury and was indicted and tried, but was acquitted and ran for re-election on the platform that he had actually been declared innocent by a court of law. And he would say, "Have you ever been declared innocent by a court of law?" And he won. I loved him more than I loved Bookie. Miss him all the time. Bookie's gotten more airtime on this. Bookie Turner and Thomas Jefferson have never really been linked as clearly as I have tried to do. Yes, sir. I'm kind of all for it, except the devil's in the details. I have found in my 10 years of doing this that the quickest way to spend a lot of time to no purpose is talk to people in Hollywood. You know what Joan Didion once said is that it's possible to die of eternal affirmation in Southern California. They all love, I love you, man. Oh, man, this is so great. Yeah, I'm sorry, you're breaking up, you know. Totally true. I'm on the, someone unusual bought the rights to Franklin and Winston, and we're on, our third or fourth screenplay, and that was 10 years ago. I will say this, I think what Spielberg did with Lincoln is hugely important. And I think it works extremely well. I'm making a lot of the points we've been talking about. And the power of, you know, even it's funny for people who do what I do, you know, we'll spend 4, 5, 6 years on a book and reach, and even if it's really successful, we will reach a fraction of people who make even a modestly successful movie will reach. And so that's the reason, joking aside, that I always pursue those possibilities seriously, because if you believe in the story you've told, it's an entirely different platform that endures in many ways. And so I've had conversations, but I'm not retiring yet. But I do have sunglasses ready. One or two more, and then we'll, yes, ma'am. Ma'am, you know, one of the things that happens when I do this a lot is people think they're at Guantanamo, and they're just having to listen to this again and again and again. It's like, remember when Waco they would just play something outside. This gets old really fast, but I appreciate it. You're very kind. You're very kind. I will refer that to my I don't really have any advisors, but if I had some, I would do it. Ann Patchett will handle all these future. One more. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Did his Renaissance interests help him match these two different skill sets, as we would call them? I think absolutely. It did. He was, you know, hugely well read. You know, he built three libraries. Since we're here, one burned at Shadwell in the early 1770s. One, which was the work of the main part of his life, he sold to Congress after the British burned Washington in 1814, and then he couldn't help himself and he built another one. So he was constantly reading history. The Iliad was hugely important to him, which I find fascinating because in the, Bill Maher, historiographically, I'm really fun to hang out with. See, this would be bad. It would get old quick, I'm telling you. He's often seen as, in fact, Gordon Wood, the fantastic dean of American historians, incredibly kind to me and wonderful. He has a sentence in one of his books that Thomas Jefferson had no tragic sense whatsoever. I disagree with that. I think he had a Homeric sense of tragedy, which was that human expectations were never going to be fully realized on this side of paradise, and that failure and disappointment were intrinsic elements of the human experience. His goal, and what he used his Renaissance skills to do, was to try to bring that gap closer together, close that gap between disappointment and hope. And that doesn't mean he wasn't a man with a tragic sensibility. It was. He was just doing something about it. And I think that that's an important part of where his interests he was able to bring things together. His interest in languages, his interest in religion. You know, I yield to few people in my editorial ego, as those of you who know me know well. But even I've never tried to redo the New Testament, you know, which Jefferson did. And it could use some tweaking, but I'm not gonna do that. So he was, you know, he was constantly thinking about these bigger ideas about human nature, but not just to have the big ideas about human nature, but in order to try to make the Republican experiment work. And one of the things that's so interesting to me about when he and John Adams reconcile at the end of their lives, they agreed about virtually nothing except the existential importance of the American experiment. For them, the Revolution was an organic thing. It was a child of theirs. They had dressed it, they had fed it, they'd seen it to an unruly adolescence, and they wanted it to grow up. And they could argue and disagree about everything short of that. But when it came to questions of national survival, they did tend to come together. And so I think that what led Jefferson to that was his ability to see that the more we learned, the more discoveries that were made. Lewis and Clark goes out, they bring back bones, he creates a room in the White House, lays them out, invites people to come play with them, to come and learn, because he believed that the world was a series of unfolding mysteries, about which he was right, right? I mean, he would have mapped the genome. He would have loved Twitter, although I don't think he could have fit everything on there. You know, although his punctuation was terrible, so he would have been perfect at email. He was the most forward-leaning of those figures because he had seen in his own life and right before his own life so much change. And this brings us full circle, so thank you. Princely and priestly authority had governed human affairs absolutely for millennia. And it was cracking up just at the moment, and because ordinary people were suddenly being granted access to the texts and the means and the ways of thinking, gathering knowledge, education, and applying those to their economic destinies, and that's what changed the world. And what Thomas Jefferson and others did is they gave political expression to the Enlightenment reordering of the world. And that is a huge legacy and, I think, in a way, burden for us. You know, reason cannot be pushed to the side in politics. We have to subject things to the test of experience and to history, not expecting that we'll get some sort of kumbaya result. We won't. But we can make it a little better. They made it a lot better. Think about what we've come through, you know, even the last, where are we? This is the 12th, 13th. I'll leave you with this. 71 years ago, this week, Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States on the 11th of December. Franklin Roosevelt, after the news of Pearl Harbor came on Sunday the 7th, never mentioned Germany in public when he declared war on the Empire of Japan, saying that the American people in their righteous might would win through to absolute victory. He didn't declare war on Hitler. Hitler declared war on us. And then we entered the war that defined and reshaped the world, including life here because of the building of the middle class and the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the various means that led us to where we are now. But Franklin Roosevelt was a politician and didn't want to jump first because he wasn't quite sure how Congress would react to declaring war on Germany. And then Hitler made the mistake from which he would never recover and did that. And then we moved forward. But I tell that story because to me it represents the contingent nature of history. You know, what if? You know, everything is, you know, a lot of things are 10% calls at the margin. That could have gone a different way. If that had gone a different way, would post-war America have developed as it did? Would the civil rights movement have developed as it did? Would women's liberation developed as it did? Would the middle class have been built as it was? No, probably not. I offer that for your consideration just because, to my mind, it comes all the way back to Jefferson and the idea that history is something we make and that nothing is inevitable. If a republic devoted to the art of reasoning and the art of learning and absolutely refusing to give in to force and the tyranny of either unthinking acceptance of ideas or any particular personality has built a country that I don't think any of us want to leave and that a lot of people want to come into. Thanks so much.